For 1 year, the message from the United States and Europe to Ukraine, to Russia, and to the world has been unequivocal. It was reiterated today by President Biden during his surprise visit to Kyiv. With Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky by his side, Biden spelled out NATO's contributions in military aid this past year to Ukraine's efforts to fend off Russia's invasion, and promised more to come.
Together, we've committed nearly 700 tanks and thousands of armored vehicles, 1,000 artillery systems, more than 2 million rounds of artillery ammunition, more than 50 advanced launch rocket systems, anti-ship and air defense systems, all to defend Ukraine. And that doesn't count the other $500 million we're announcing with you today and tomorrow. That's going to be coming your way.
In return, he said, Ukraine has inspired countries around the world with its determination to defeat the Russian invaders.
It's astounding. Astounding. Remind us that freedom is priceless. It's worth fighting for as long as it takes. And that's how long we're going to be with you, Mr. President, for as long as it takes.
For as long as it takes. That has been the consistent mantra for a year.
We're going to stand with you as long as it takes.
We will remain at Ukraine's side for as long as it takes.
Make no mistake, we will support Ukraine's self-defense for as long as it takes.
The United States will continue to strongly support Ukraine, and we will do so for as long as it takes.
In addition to President Biden, you also heard European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen, Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin, and Vice President Kamala Harris, all reiterating that same message. But as the war enters its second year, just how long will it take? And if the U.S. and Europe are committed to supporting Ukraine for as long as it takes, do they have the wherewithal for how much that could take? I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store, in for Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. This hour, where Ukraine's war and the crucial support from Western nations go from here. Joining me from Washington is Natalia Bugayova. She's the Russia Fellow at the Institute for the Study of War. Her work focuses on Russia's military and information operations globally. Natalia, welcome to On Point, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Kimberly.
So I want to start out by talking about the other part of Biden's message, saying that the war, that the U.S. support for Ukraine in this war is, quote, unwavering, and pledging additional resources. What did you think about that, and how important is it at this juncture?
It is a critical message. There are two centers of gravity in this war. One is Ukraine's will to fight, and the second is Ukraine's support of Ukraine's defense. President Biden reinforcing Western support is critical at this point, especially as Russia is ramping up its information operations, targeting precisely unity between Ukraine and the West.
So let's talk about where things stand right now with the new spring offensive by Russia and Ukraine's counteroffensive. Where does that stand? Has the ramp up in fighting by Russia already begun?
Yeah, so the current Russian offensive in eastern Ukraine is underway, but it's yielding little progress. And Ukraine will likely soon have an opportunity to exploit Russian setbacks through its own counteroffensive. But first, I'd like to actually put the current point in the war in the broader context of the key milestones of the past year. And bottom line is that Russia hasn't achieved significant operational successes in Ukraine since July of last year. It had initiative from February to July, but Russian offensive has culminated in part after Russia exhausted a lot of its resources in pursuit of very limited gains in Lysychansk, Severodonetsk. And since that, Ukraine seized initiative, and launched its counteroffensive with several successful operations and managed to liberate almost 18,000 square kilometers of territory. Ukraine momentum has slowed in part because Western military aid was a step behind Ukraine's needs, and that what provided Russia opportunity to stabilize its lines and, you know, reinforce the offensive around Bakhmut. And as of 2 weeks ago, Russia launched its offensive in Luhansk Oblast, and that's where we are right now.
Okay, and you talked about Russia having some missteps. Do you think they have learned from those and have recovered, and we will see fewer of those moving forward, or are they still in some ways disadvantaged?
No, great question. Russia's military campaign is very costly, and also Ukraine's relentless defense of Bakhmut and Russia's missteps have significantly depleted Russia's ability for a large-scale counteroffensive in eastern Ukraine, which means, in my assessment and that of my colleagues, the offensive is likely to culminate without producing decisive gains. There may be some gains, like capture of Bakhmut, but it won't alter a strategic situation. And in the major phase of Russian offensive Luhansk Oblast, as we observe right now, Russia still lacks sufficient reserves that are uncommitted to drastically increase the pace of that offensive, which means that it also likely culminate very short of achieving significant gains.
So this additional resources that was pledged by President Biden, another $500 million worth, I know there is a push for Congress to commit billions more on top of that. What does Ukraine need to be able to continue its counteroffensive and regain ground against Russia?
Yeah, at this point, once again, we assess that Ukraine is able to further liberate its critical terrain and also its people with the Western help. The Western support should match the design of Ukraine's counteroffensive, and the package that has been promised matches that in large part. I would also like to just reinforce that as we look ahead, the priority of the U.S. to provide additional aid is also aligns with core understanding that liberating additional terrain is very essential in this war. Because if Russia keeps its gains in Ukraine, territorial gains in Ukraine, the Kremlin will have a chance to reconstitute its military over time, launch future attacks, because Kremlin has stated unambiguously it will do both. Have a chance to reconnect its military gains in Ukraine, connected military gains in Ukraine and Belarus, which would impose significantly larger requirements on the U.S. and NATO. And I think the Western support and the package that is geared towards helping Ukraine liberate additional territory reflects that understanding.
And we will talk a little more later about all of the dilemmas and challenges in fighting this war. But I just want to ask, how likely is it that others join the fight on Russia's behalf? Belarus, for example, or if China begins providing forces on behalf of Russia?
Yeah. In terms of Belarus, the Kremlin has been trying to force Belarus to fully commit to fighting this war with Russia for the past year. And so far, Russia has failed to do so. Now, let's make no mistake. Belarus is a co-belligerent in this war, and it's providing Russia a staging ground from which Russia launches attacks. It helps Russia with the military equipment and so on and so forth. But the reason that Russia still hasn't been able to force Belarus to fully join is because, actually, I think it reflects the limits of Russia's power. And even if Belarus does join, the likelihood of that is being very low. It will unlikely to have a decisive impact on the battlefield dynamics. In terms of China, China has been hesitant to a degree to provide all the military aid and technology that Russia certainly hoped, I believe in the beginning of the war, that Russia would. And I think U.S. been very clear with China that there will be ramifications of fully supporting Russia in this war in Ukraine. China continues to, of course, support Russia in the information realm and reinforce some of Russia's longstanding information operations. But it likely has many considerations in national security interests of its own that do not align with Russia's unprovoked invasion of Ukraine.
And with the aid from the United States, as well as other Western allies, such as Germany and Britain, is that help going to arrive in time? Meaning, will they get the tanks, the equipment, and even the training that they need in time to be able to continue this counteroffensive?
Yeah, that's a great question. First, we've seen what happens when Western aid is behind Ukraine's battlefield needs. Specifically, Ukraine has had two successive counteroffensive operations. First, when it liberated significant territories in the Kharkiv region early in the fall, and then, of course, the liberation of Kherson City. Ukraine could have then moved on to fully utilize the opportunity that Russian setbacks on a battlefield have presented, if Western military aid have arrived in time and if Western military aid was essentially preempting the requirements and picking up on indicators that Russian offensive would have culminated in the middle of the summer, and that was the time to start planning subsequent phases of Ukraine's counteroffensive. As we look ahead, I think the West should learn this lesson, should learn from the recent experience and make sure that when Ukraine has the next opportunity to exploit Russian battlefield setbacks, it is fully resourced to do so.
Natalia, we're going to have you hold right there. We're discussing the West's support for Ukraine and Russia's now year-long invasion. Will it be enough for Ukraine to prevail the coming spring fighting? And what happens after that? I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. We're talking about the war in Ukraine 1 year in and whether the U.S. and other NATO members can sustain their current levels of support. I've been speaking with Natalia Bugayova, who is a fellow at the Institute for the Study of War. And I'd like to bring another voice into the discussion. Miranda Preeb is the director of the Center for Analysis of U.S. Grand Strategy at the RAND Corporation. She recently co-authored a paper titled Avoiding a Long War, and we have a link to it on our website at onpointradio.org. She too joins us from Washington. Miranda, welcome to On Point.
Thanks so much for having me.
So, Miranda, I want to start by asking, at this juncture, a year in, what do you think is more likely, the possibility that one side or the other will be able to declare a decisive victory or a protracted war of attrition?
So it seems at this stage really unlikely that either side can win a decisive victory. When we talk about a decisive victory, we're usually talking about one side destroying the military capacity or the government that has, you know, that is fighting this war. And so early in the war, Russia did seem to be trying to totally defeat Ukraine by overthrowing the government in Kyiv. And, you know, as Natalia was explaining, limits on Russian military capacity meant that it couldn't achieve that objective. And there's nothing indicating that they're going to be able to anytime soon. At the same time, the Ukrainians have been fighting incredibly well and, you know, exceeding everyone's pre-war expectations. But even if they were to push Russia entirely out of Ukraine, the war wouldn't necessarily be over. It wouldn't be able to be a decisive victory if Russia continued to keep fighting. So at this point, go ahead.
No, please continue.
Oh, I was just going to say, at this point, I think that's an unlikely outcome, and protracted conflict is more likely.
So what, when the president says the U.S. will support Ukraine as long as it takes, is that a promise that he can keep if this war continues to go on with no end in sight?
Yeah, I think it's important to break that question down into can he and should he. So the can is a question of domestic politics and, you know, the opinion of U.S. leaders about whether to keep fighting this war. And we know right now that polls are kind of trending against continued support to Ukraine, although they aren't particularly low either. But I think the bigger question that I'd like to see the country debating is, should we? You know, does it make sense for the United States to help keep a conflict going that could last for years? And we haven't really had that debate because we've been just so focused on the immediate crisis before us.
Well, let's have a bit of that debate now. Natalia Bugayeva, what do you think? Should the U.S. pledge support as long as it takes?
Yeah, so I think Ukraine, as we discussed, still is able to liberate critical terrain, and it's in U.S. interest that it does. Why? Because whether Russia keeps or loses its gains in Ukraine is key determinant not just for Russia's prospects in Ukraine, but for the future of Russia's power. And I think the arguments that because Russia is already weakened and thus additional advantage to the U.S. from weakened Russia is marginal ignores this core reality. Because if Russia does keep Ukraine gains, it will give Kremlin a chance to reconstitute, as we talk, launch future attacks, connect its military gains in Ukraine and Belarus, and likely Moldova over time. The requirements that would impose on the U.S., on NATO, on the EU, and additional vulnerabilities that it will create, especially as U.S. is thinking about long-term competition with China, will be enormous. And look, U.S. will have the same obligation to support NATO allies in the future Russian attacks on Ukraine as Ukraine does now, which means U.S. is risking facing the same problem with the same escalation risk, but under worse conditions in the future if it does not help Ukraine's large-scale offensive now.
And Miranda, what do you say to that? Is there a danger of losing the gains that have been made if the U.S. does not continue its unwavering support?
I think we have a Natalia and I have a different view about how much Russia can use the gains that it's, you know, if Russia were to reach a ceasefire with Ukraine and continue holding the territory it currently controls, it's not clear how much that would redound to Russia's advantage and make it more capable in the future. Any pause in the fighting would give both sides a chance to reconstitute and to build up. So I don't think the case that Natalia is making is quite as clear cut. You know, another argument that we often hear about the U.S. continuing this fight or continuing to supply Ukraine in this fight is that it will show Russia and other potential aggressors that the United States stands by countries around the world when they're met with aggression. And that's certainly something that is a U.S. Important to the United States, but I think the assessment of how much U.S. credibility would be hurt by adjusting its aid to Ukraine or placing more conditions on aid to Ukraine have been oversimplified.
So I want to talk a little bit about some of the challenges that the U.S. And its NATO allies may have even as they try to pledge unwavering support. First of all, there may be difficulties in Congress now with a Republican-controlled Congress here in the U.S. There may be, it may be harder to keep up the levels of support they've had in the past, not to mention the overall economic climate. And also, it's uncertain how long the NATO unity will hold out, whether all of the allies will remain as steadfast. Miranda, first to you, talk a little bit about how the U.S. and Ukraine navigate those challenges.
Yeah, I mean, I think those are real realities, and I don't know that we can totally overcome them. I think part of those realities, the fact that there is potentially slipping domestic support and, you know, the risk of allied support declining in the future are a reason for the administration to begin considering a nearer term end to this war, you know, how to bring about negotiations in the near term rather than just letting events play out on the ground.
And Natalia, what do you think? There are these challenges, and it may be difficult for Biden and the U.S. to maintain the level of support they have up until now.
Certainly. I think there are two parts to this. The first, there are real challenges, and then there are perceived challenges. There are certainly difference of opinions on the scale, speed, extent of the support to Ukraine, but there is unity on their underlying premise that the unprovoked invasion of Ukraine should not be rewarded. And it's the underlying national security interest of those states that's, I think, the fundamental driver of support for Ukraine and not just moral and humanitarian considerations. Second, on the point of the perceived divergences, you know, we've seen all throughout the past 12 months that one of the most important, the largest Russian investment in the information space has been to drive apart the unity between Ukraine and its Western partners. Originally, they manifested, those information operations manifested themselves as calls to not supply Ukraine with arms early in the war, and saying that essentially Russia is such a great power that it wouldn't matter whether Ukraine had any weapons. Then those information operations switched to trying to create essentially pessimism about any ability of Ukraine to regain terrain in the summer of last year. And I remember actually being asked by media the same question about the war of attrition. But then, of course, Ukraine went on a massive counteroffensive. Then those information operations shifted to the nuclear threats that then tamed, and later to essentially the calls for some sort of a ceasefire and peace deals. They were clearly intended to slow the provision of Western tanks to Ukraine. So I think we should be very cognizant of their real challenges, but their also perception of disunity or a lack of unity that's driven by Russia.
I want to talk about some other challenges and risks. Secretary of State Antony Blinken told NATO allies this weekend that the U.S. has information that China may be considering providing Russia with lethal aid in its war effort. U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations Linda Thomas-Greenfield warned on NBC that that would be crossing a red line.
If there are any thoughts and efforts by the Chinese and others to provide lethal support to the Russians in their brutal attack against Ukraine, that is unacceptable. Again, that would be a red line.
Miranda, how big of a risk do you think this is, and what that might do to the ability to US, of the U.S. to keep up its support and the U.S.-Chinese relationship?
Yeah, I think it's a great question. The possibility of China increasing its military support to Russia is really important because it could help Russia fight longer and, you know, resupply some of the areas where it might be running short on equipment or supplies. And I think it highlights the broader issue that as the war continues for months, for years to come, that there all these other possibilities remain open. The possibility that China might start arming Russia is one, but also the possibility that this war could escalate, you know, to involve the United States, or that, you know, in the extreme, that Russia could use nuclear weapons. So I think this incident or this new information about China really just highlights all these possibilities that still remain out there, that what we're looking at on the ground today might not stay that way as the fighting continues.
Natalia, what risk do you think China poses at this juncture?
Yeah, I think it really comes down to the question of the key dynamics that are driving this war. And I think there are three. One is intent of the sides. The second is capability. And the third is perception of intent and capability by various sides. We know that Russia's intent is inflexible and is unlikely to change. So the variable that's actually flexible, and we as the U.S. And West has a lot of power to shape is capability. When we talk about China's support, potential support at a larger scale, it is something that can help reinforce Russia's capability to sustain this war. But it's certainly not the only and not the most important element, because there are other elements of Russia's capability, including manpower, including its own defense industrial base ability to produce weapons. And that defense industrial base is quite vulnerable. Its momentum and the territory that it keeps, those are all elements of Russia's capability. And both Ukraine and the West have a lot of agency and shaping those. And I actually disagree that there is limitless number of possibilities out there. They're actually quite finite, because Russia already pulled a lot of resources from any place that it could, be it from the countries in the former Soviet states that it's trying to control, like Belarus, from its domestic reserves. It is gearing up for, Russia is preparing for a long war, but I think the possibilities from where it can get more resources are actually not limitless. They are finite.
And Natalia, Miranda mentioned the possibility of Russia using nuclear weapons and even a potential escalation, especially if China gets involved in the Russia-NATO conflict. What do you think about those risks?
No, great question. I would separate out the conventional and nuclear escalation. On the convention side, Russia has limited abilities at present to meaningfully escalate against NATO. But the risk of NATO-Russia escalation grows, in my assessment, if Russia keeps gains in Ukraine and is allowed to rebuild its conventional military force. In terms of the nuclear escalation, I think we must separate the discussion of Russia's use of nukes in Ukraine and from the discussion of Russia using a nuclear weapon against a NATO country. In terms of Ukraine, we cannot rule it out, of course. However, there are two points here. One, first of all, Ukraine has been taking that risk since the moment Ukraine to choose to fight back. Ukraine chooses to take that risk in no small part because Putin has shown what the alternative to fighting is. It's death, it's torture, it's deportation under the Russian occupation. Secondly, the use of nukes is a very big gamble for Putin in Ukraine for potentially very limited gain and an extreme cost. And I'm happy to elaborate on that. I think the discussion about Russia potentially using a nuclear weapon against a NATO state really should boil down to two things. One, discuss it in the context of a nuclear deterrence, and we either believe it works or we have a larger problem to discuss. And second, if we decide that U.S. can never run a risk of nuclear escalation, it means we've just subordinated our entire national security policy to any power with nuclear weapons. We've also encouraged every revisionist power out there to try to get a nuclear weapon. And I really want to hear an argument of why that version of the world is better than taking an extremely small risk of Putin engaging in a nuclear suicide.
So we have a comment from a listener, Daniel Everett, on Facebook, who says, Putin is grinning because he's reasonably sure he now has a war of attrition where he envisions at least some of Ukraine's land will be forfeited in the same way that Crimea was stolen and incorporated into Russia. Will the world do anything to Putin or his successors to prevent further illegal wars of annexation? Miranda, to that point, what might the end game look here, especially if this ends up a war, a long-term war of attrition, and that way isn't that a win for Putin?
Well, I think a lot of times this listener's question reflects a point of view that we also see in the administration, which is that if Russia holds any Ukrainian territory through some kind of ceasefire or broader peace settlement, that it's going to embolden Russia or other countries to take more territory in the future. And I think what that point of view tends to miss is that the United States and its allies, along with Ukraine, have already imposed significant costs on Russia for this war. Russia has been, obviously facing high rates of casualties. The Russian economy has suffered to some degree from the sanctions, and Russia has seen countries in Europe join NATO that might not have otherwise. And so there, it's difficult to imagine that Russia or other countries are going to look on this Russian misadventure, which has revealed Russia's military weakness, and think, oh, that, you know, that was easy, that was great. I think I'm going to, you know, take some territory myself now. I just think that the way that countries assess credibility and assess the risks of using force is much more complicated than the simple calculus of focusing on territory.
Well, that's Miranda and Natalia to hold right there. We're talking about the war in Ukraine and Europe's and the U.S.'s military support for Ukraine. And we're talking about the moral, geopolitical, and economic choices they are confronting as the war enters its second year. When we return, what can NATO countries do to shorten this war? I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
Smart journalism, fascinating topics. Words that describe CNN's podcast, The Assignment with Audie Cornish.
Last year, the Army missed its recruitment goal. It had 65,000 spots to fill and came up 10,000 short of that target. Why is it so hard to recruit? How's the Pentagon responding? And how are the voices of service members on social media shifting the balance?
Listen to The Assignment with Audie Cornish wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. My guests this hour are Natalia Bugayova, a Russia fellow at the Institute for the Study of War, and Miranda Priebe. She's the director of the Center for Analysis of U.S. Grand Strategy at the RAND Corporation. And we're discussing the West's difficult dilemma. How long can the West continue to support Ukraine? And what can the West do to bring Russia and the Ukraine to the bargaining table and bring the war to a close? So before we get into a discussion of how this war might be shortened, I want to continue our discussion about potential endgames. We talked about the likelihood of a decisive victory on one side or another. We also talked about a war of attrition. But Natalia, what about an armistice agreement or a peace settlement? Is there a chance, in your view, that the Kremlin would be motivated to engage in peace talks?
Great question. I think the discussions of a premature ceasefire or a peace agreement presupposes first that there is some amount of land that we can give to Vladimir Putin that will stop him from attacking Ukraine. Or it also presupposes that Russia's intent regarding Ukraine can change and that Russia will use territory that it keeps in Ukraine for anything other than trying to regroup and launch its further attacks. And I think that premise is flawed. We've seen times and times over that Kremlin's intent in Ukraine is inflexible. And it has always been more than just about territory, more than just about countering NATO or forcing Ukraine into neutrality, and certainly not been about protecting Russian speakers, given how many Russian-speaking Ukrainians Russian forces have killed, tortured, and deported. So the intent is not only inflexible, we don't see any indication, any evidence that is likely to change. Vladimir Putin is gearing Russia for a long war. He's codifying his gains in Ukraine into Russian constitution, and the power brokers in Russia and society are also consolidating implicitly or explicitly around this agenda. Ceasefires, conversation about ceasefires, peace talks, negotiations, they all imply that one can change Putin's intent. And I don't believe that's possible. So instead of spending time on policies that fail times and times over, I think U.S. and Ukraine should focus on policies that actually work, which is targeting Russia's capability to act on its intent. It's one of the reasons why Russia isn't occupying Kyiv. It's not because Putin has given up on the goal of occupying Kyiv. It's because he was denied capability to do so.
Miranda, what do you think? Is any sort of peace talks even possible?
It's a really difficult question because, of course, there's so many reasons why the two parties haven't engaged in negotiations since the beginning of the war. But, you know, when we look back at history and how conflicts ultimately end, we see that, you know, even countries that felt this way, that felt that there was no room for negotiation, can sometimes come to a ceasefire or a broader peace agreement to end the war. And so, you know, the United States and its allies have options for trying to increase that likelihood. We can't, you know, determine whether they will ultimately come to negotiations, because that's really ultimately up to the parties themselves. But we can create the conditions.
And what might creating those conditions look like?
Yeah, so I think a really helpful way to think about it is that the way that you try to bring parties to the negotiating table is to do two things. One is to make them more pessimistic about what they can gain by continuing to fight, and the other is to make them more optimistic about what they can gain by choosing peace. And so the U.S. and its allies can try to change those beliefs through different policy options. For example, you know, one reason that Ukraine has been hesitant to come to the negotiating table is just as Natalia laid out, that they don't believe that Russia is going to change its ultimate intentions. So one way that the United States and its partners could try to address that is to offer Ukraine substantial support and security guarantees of some kind after some agreement is reached. And that kind of thing could help them have more confidence that we can deter Russia in the future and therefore more willing to engage in peace talks.
So I want to talk a little bit about what ending the war, shortening the war might take. Early in the war, the West imposed strict new sanctions on Russia, but Russia's central bankers managed to protect the country from financial collapse. Alexandra Prokopenko was an advisor for the central bank until she fled the country soon after the war began. She warns that Russia can continue to withstand Western sanctions.
I don't think that economic pressure will bring Putin to the negotiation table. He has a lot of resources at his disposal to continue this war. He still has at least half of his reserves. He is still able to sell oil and oil products to China, India, and the rest of the world. And he also can continue finance deficit with internal borrowing. So unfortunately, sanctions and economic struggling wouldn't bring him to the negotiation table.
So, Natalia, talk a little bit about sanctions. That's something that we've heard a lot about since the war began. Do you think they've been effective? And do you think that discussions, negotiations about what the terms of lifting those sanctions might be is something that might bring Vladimir Putin to the table?
Yeah, I think sanctions are definitely a key part of limiting Russia's capability to sustain this war, especially those sanctions that are targeting the defense industrial base and making sure that the West, at minimum, is not amplifying Russia with access to its own technology and markets. And I think in some cases they have been effective. And as we look ahead and look at the traditional military capability, meaning manpower and weapon systems, you know, Putin will not hesitate to throw more people, Russian people, into this war. And we shouldn't underestimate the ability of Russian society to normalize new and worse reality and get in line. But people don't necessarily mean instant combat capable manpower. Therefore, defense industrial base of Russia is going to be a core dynamic that will determine how long Russia can sustain this war. And sanctions actually have been effective. I think they need to be expanded. I want to just build on the broader question of you know, the end game that you were raising, and also what works and what doesn't. Fortunately, we know what works, right? If we actually, we shouldn't forget that as we look on the past 12 months, Ukraine, with Western help, has achieved massive military success and defeated Russia in the Battle of Kiev, Kharkiv, expelled Russia from Kharkiv region, expelled Russia from the only regional capital that Russia held since February of last year, liberated massive amounts of territory, 18,000 square kilometers, as we discussed, and it is on track to liberate more. And U.S. should focus on helping Ukraine counteroffensive succeed in 2023 and only then reassess options. You know, I think there is a lot of discussion of preemptively handicapping our own U.S. own options here, where we are not yet at the point of hard choices. And I really want to emphasize this point. We should not preemptively self-deter when we are far from exhausting tools in our arsenal to achieve our own objectives.
Thanks for making that point. And I'm going to come back to where Ukraine is and given that the gains that it's made. But I want to talk a little bit more about sanctions. Alexandra Prokopenko, the former advisor for Russia's central bank, also said that since Western sanctions haven't worked, the only entities that can bring Russia to the negotiating table are its major allies.
I think China and maybe Turkey, that's the options the rest of the world can use to bring Putin to negotiations. I think that raising pressure from these countries can help. So for the West, the option is work closely with the Chinese leader or with Erdogan and convince them to convince Putin to stop the war.
Miranda, what do you think about that? Do you think that Erdogan or Xi can be the one that can convince Putin to negotiate?
I think it's difficult to say right now, you know, how much leverage they might have over Russia as things go forward. But I think it's certainly a good point that there are other players other than the United States that might have a role to play in bringing about negotiations at some point. But that doesn't mean that the United States doesn't have some options itself. As I talked about a minute ago, you know, one of the ways that you try to increase the odds of negotiation is to make peace attractive. So, you know, what are the things the United States and its allies can do to make peace more appealing to Russia? One of those options might be committing, as was discussed earlier in the war, to Ukrainian neutrality, committing not to put U.S. forces into Ukraine or to allow Ukraine to join NATO. And those are that would be a very politically difficult choice for the United States to make. But I think these are the kinds of options that the country needs to start debating. I understand Tali's point about not wanting to start negotiations now, but negotiations are historically very time-consuming and difficult to achieve. It took 2 years to negotiate the armistice in the Korean War. So I think the key point to think about is, you know, having a national conversation about what our options are, what our interests are, and beginning to think more creatively about ways to change the party's views about that, the benefits of continuing to fight versus choosing peace.
And Miranda, you recently, along with your colleagues at RAND, laid out what the U.S. should be doing, in your view, to bring the war to a close as quickly as possible. Can you just quickly go through what your recommendations are?
Sure. I've already mentioned a couple of them, which is that, you know, one direction is to think about what commitments the United States is willing to make as part of a post-war settlement. And that probably includes something like the parties talked about in the Istanbul communique early in the war, which is pairing some kind of guarantee of support to Ukraine in the future with also a promise of Ukrainian neutrality. And that would make both sides more confident that, you know, peace could last and also give them both a reason to see peace as more beneficial, as we know that Putin has long hoped to keep Ukraine out of NATO. Other kind of tough choices to think about are offering Russia a path to sanctions relief. Although the sanctions have been slow to degrade the Russian economy, they are a long-term challenge for Russia, as we know, and it has undermined growth to some degree. So as part of a negotiation process, the U.S. and its allies could consider offering Russia a pathway to getting those relieved in exchange for concessions to Ukraine. And then finally, you know, this is probably the most difficult option to talk about, but the United States could begin to place more conditions or limits on its support to Ukraine unless it engages really genuinely in negotiations with Russia. And that's a politically difficult, morally difficult thing to do when a country has been invaded. But at the same time, it's, I think, you know, one of the options, one of the tools in the U.S. toolkit that we have to talk about and think about and consider whether it has a role to play in our next steps.
Natalia, I want you to react to those recommendations and also say what you think is needed right now to bring this war to a conclusion as quickly as possible.
Thank you. A couple of reactions. First, the conversation about neutrality. It presupposes that neutrality would be enough for the Kremlin. And we've observed plenty of evidence over the course of the years that this war was always more for Russia than just neutrality or just counting NATO. And, you know, I don't think one can have it both ways to claim that Russia somehow felt threatened by Ukraine's militarily and that know that Russia was planning to take Kiev and conquer Ukraine in 3 days based on Russia's own assessment of how they thought insignificant Ukraine's military challenge was. One cannot have it both ways, claim that it is about neutrality and a genuine Russian perception of conventional threat from NATO, and observe Russia now pulling forces away from its closest NATO border in Kola Peninsula, as we're observing, or Putin being very clear that he's not seeing Sweden or Finland joining NATO as a paramount threat. So I just wanted to make that point. I think a lot of the conversations about eventual peace, the one that Miranda outlined and others are making arguments for, presupposes that Ukraine will give up certain territory, including potentially areas that Russia is holding now after after what it seized since February of last year. But terrain matters. And I think it's really erroneous and dangerous to assume that U.S. can avoid a long war without helping to liberate Ukraine's territory further. Why? Because territory matters. Terrain is the core part of Russia's capability to sustain this war. Russia will use any territory, especially in the vital south of Ukraine, as a permanent staging ground. We know that because we live in Russian strategy now, and Russia launched its 2022 invasion from the occupied territories. And the reason it controls Black Sea coast right now is because it was in Crimea. So we might really start recognizing territory as a core element of Russian capability to sustain this war alongside traditional military capability. Final point I'll make that I think those who argue that Ukraine should give up some additional terrain should be very explicit that they understand that this policy is condemning those living on Russian-occupied territories to perpetual atrocities. One should be explicit that they understand the human cost and they still recommend the U.S. policymakers and American public that supports foreign policies should accept that cost. And I think the final point is, look, we have overwhelming evidence that Russia will likely use that territory to stage future attacks, and U.S. will be drawn into this war again, likely on much worse conditions down the road. So I think there should be another very strong burden of argumentation placed on those arguing this course of action of why is that a preferable in terms of U.S. foreign policy interests.
Natalia Bugayova is a Russia fellow at the Institute for the Study of War. Natalia, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
And Miranda Priebe is the director of the Center for Analysis of U.S. Grand Strategy at the RAND Corporation. Miranda, thank you too.
Thanks for having me.
I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. This is On Point.